Okay, let's go ahead and take a look at the map of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, and a little bit of Montana. This area in green is what is called the Columbia River Basalt. It's a huge area, all the way through the Columbia Gorge, following the river all the way back up into Washington. Most of it, the river is running through, the Columbia River running through the Columbia River basalts. There is a total of about 300 separate flows. Two of them, the Imnaha and Saddle Mountain, are down here in Oregon, and then the rest of them are mostly up, some in Oregon, but mostly in Washington. And that's the Grand Ronde, the Imnaha, the Grand Ronde, the Wanapum, and one other. And the Grand Ronde has 200 separate flows. And each flow is anywhere from 20 feet deep, flow of hot lava moving, on up to 200 feet thick. That's a lot of lava moving. It has to stay hot. It comes out of the ground. Let me use the laser here. Right over in this area of the state, there are what they call cracks in the earth, dike swarms, where the lava has come up and then it flows. And it just fills all the low spots, and then it eventually makes itself a platform so it can go all the way from here, following the little bit lower terrain, and it takes it all the way out to the ocean. Not all of them went that far, okay? Some of them were foundational builders, and then the other layers were built on top of that. In the Yakima area, it's 2 miles deep of lava. There's about 100 separate flows there. When it gets into the gorge, there's less in quantity. Some of those made it through, but a lot of them, like I say, of the total of 300, maybe 100 of them made it through the gorge. Now, at that time, when I say through the gorge, I better correct myself, there was no gorge. Because if you look on both sides of the gorge, as you're going up from Portland on up to Hood River and then on out to the Dalles, you'll find that you can see on both sides of the river the layers, and you get so you can connect them up. Okay, so there was no river gorge there at the time this lava was flowing. And I'll be showing you some slides here that shows when and under what conditions these flows happened. Was it subaerial, just in the air, or was it subaqueous, underwater? And we'll be showing that. Now, you're familiar with basalt columns. There's the Columbia River basalt. Let's see if I can make that bigger. There we go. Notice they don't always have to be vertical. They can be bent. They can be huge. They can be small. Small around as my arm. 20 feet in diameter at times. Individual flows. You see there's a contact, and usually as you look at them, it's kind of like stair steps on the side of the canyon. So at the top of this bottom flow, there's a little bit of a ledge. Originally, the flows completely was clear across the valley. It's after the global flood water. These lava layers were laid down underwater by Noah's flood. under the flood water. They were laid down. So when the land starts to rise and the what's going to be the ocean bottom starts to sink, the water flows off, and you're a lot of power, a lot of erosion takes place, carries a lot of material out. In fact, all of the river channels of the world are formed at that time. There's been a little modification by activity since then, but the basic carving of the river channels was done at that time. So it's cutting down through, in our area, basalt. It's cutting down through other material in other places in the world. Now, here we're looking at the top of the columns. And if you look carefully, you can see that, look, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sides. That's the basic hexagonal shape of the columns. Now, you'll find some that might be only 5 instead of 6, maybe some that are 4. In a crowded situation, sometimes they don't form out the full 6 sides just because it's too crowded. Well, that crack that you see there, and it goes all the way down, but it's not large. It's only a little larger here because of erosion. But when you get down back on that wall that we showed at first, you can't put a piece of paper between the columns. But water, by capillary action, can go up in there. And at wintertime, if it freezes, it puts a little pressure on that column. And over the years, all that pressure happening with freezing water in the very small crack, cracks around the column will cause them to fall down. And you've seen, like, in some places, it looks like a post pile, you know, post parts of the columns laying there. Other places, it's just rubble because it broke up in smaller pieces. Here's some photographs that I took just a couple of days ago in the gorge at Hood River, and just a little bit to on the Washington side, about 6 miles from Bingen, going towards Lyle. Now, here is a contact, like I mentioned on that one of the slides earlier. Here's another contact up here, and you can see there's a little bit of grass growing on part of it. Contact is where one flow has come over the top of the other one. And so let's look at the next slide here. Now here you see the contact again, but then here's this odd structure on the top, okay? That's got some petrified wood in it. And this is on one side of the road cut at Chamberlain State Park, about 7 miles from Bingen, and about 0.4 mile down in the deep road cut as you go down the road towards Lyle on the Washington side. Now here's a structure. This is like that one that I just showed on the other slide, but it's on the other side of the road, and it's larger here. Let me describe what we have. Go to the next slide here, I think. Okay, this is a little bit closer. Right across here, when I first started showing this to my college students and then to trips that I would take people from the communities out to see, that was a log. It was about 8 feet long and about 10 inches in diameter, and it was rounded, and there was a branch in one place. Somebody placed a geocache right there in a little hole, a branch that had fallen out, petrified, and stuck it in there. Well, what did they do with geocaches? How do people find those? They go on the internet, geocache, and they find all the different places they can go. And those that decided they'd come to the Columbia River Gorge and go to this site at Chamberlain State Park, they find it, but they see, ooh, look at all this petrified wood. So they help themselves. So pretty soon, all the petrified wood is mostly gone, and there's a hollow there now instead of the log like it used to be. And that happened in about 6 months. Between two of my trips, the log was there, and then it was gone. Now, if you notice here, you can see some chunks of petrified wood here, okay? And they're right in this area below this part of the basalt and above the lower layer of basalt. And I've got this at an angle. It's not tilted that much. It's pretty much horizontal. That was to take the picture. Now, that big mound that has the petrified wood in it, I mentioned earlier, did this lava flow underwater or did it flow subaerial? Okay, well, if you look at this structure right up here, this is a couple of pillows. They call it pillow lava. And you see that it's kind of got a rounded shape. Okay, let me go to the next one and we'll see even more. And this material here is the combination of basalt lava and petrified wood mixed together. And how did this wood get there? Well, if you're, and this happened when Noah's flood is over the earth, okay? And so the lava is coming out in eastern Washington underwater, under Noah's flood water. And it's flowing and putting all these layers down there. And it's following the terrain underwater, and there's enough slope that it can flow. And this is actually it's midway in the flood, because later the river channel is going to be carved through it, okay, for the Columbia Gorge, Columbia River. Now, why is the color different right here from the basalt up in here? And this is what happens when hot basalt, maybe it's 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, it needs a high temperature to be able to flow underwater, and then the surface cools, but it stays hot inside. So it's like you have a long balloon, okay, and the balloon keeps getting longer and longer and longer as more lava comes and breaks out, and that cools, and it breaks out more and cools. So it stays hot inside, and it can go clear from eastern Washington, flowing inside the lava tube all the way to the coast. Or in most cases here, it's more than just a tube, it's a whole sheet. Okay, you saw that first map. A portion of the distance across that green map would be where the lava flow. The current lava flow is there, and there's others underneath it, and there'll be more on top. So it's called pelagonite when it has this lighter yellowish, reddish, rusty color, as well as the yellowish tan. That's it. It's a chemical reaction with the water. Now, how did the wood get there? Well, at Spirit Lake, remember after the blast, the trees got blown down by the 300 mile an hour stone wind, blew the branches off, ripped the tree trunk out, left the roots there, and some of them ended up in Spirit Lake, and others pointing away from the volcano on the ground. Well, those floating on the lake, eventually they waterlog, and they start to go the heavier end, even though it doesn't have the roots, the root end is going to be heavier, so it starts to go down. So now it's bobbing above the water surface a little bit. Then it'll drop clear to the bottom, and if nothing holds it upright, it'll get waterlogged and lay down, and you'll have a log when it gets covered with muds, and there's a lot of minerals in the water from the volcanic activity, and especially when there's eruption, things adding more to it, so it petrifies. But if the tree that is has landed is still vertical, when let's say a lava, a lot of ash and pumice floats, but some of the other lava types come in there, and they can bury the base of it, it'll stay upright. Maybe a mud flow comes down and goes into the water and helps hold it upright. So they will then be buried and petrified in the vertical position. Now what you see here is here's the ledge on top of the lower lava flow, and then this is the upper lava flow that came over the top of it. But right in here, where this stick is pointing in here, is compressed leaves and branches and twigs and grass and vegetation, and it's very black, and you can pull it out. It's almost like coal, and you can see a little bit of it right down in here, and then this blackish part in here. And it tends to weather out as the water comes down. That's why there's a cavity back there. Okay, here I'm folding some of that blackish material, compressed, and it is, it's no longer, you know, green, it's black because it has been modified by the heat of the wall of the flowing lava, and some minerals have been added to it as well. So you can have some petrified wood in other places, and you can have this compressed coalified material from all the high temperature and the pressure on it. Now here's the last shot in the gorge, and you see the bottom layer here. I guess you can see my arrow here. Notice that there's vesicles or air bubbles. If you take a bottle of shampoo and you flip it upside down, the air bubbles that will start coming up like upside down teardrops coming up to the top. Well, same thing with the lava. As the gas is leaving from a mixture inside the whole flow of lava, it's coming up. And so the top of the lava flow will have the gas bubbles in it. But now up here, this is the bottom of the next flow, and it doesn't have any gas bubbles. But if you go clear to the top of this flow, you'll find gas bubbles. So there's time for the gas to be moving up, because it likely stayed hot for months before it was cool enough that the bubbles couldn't come up. But it was still thick, so they didn't come up real fast. Your lava is not flowing like syrup. It's flowing like something much heavier or more viscous. Okay, yeah, the right term. Being viscous means it resists flow. The more viscous it is, the thicker it is, the more it resists flow. Basalt is the least viscous of the lava types. So, and that's why it can, you know, flow great distances. The lava that comes down, if it's not basalt, if it's the other two types, andesite, one of them, and there's one other one. Those lavas are more viscous. And the one that makes a dome is so viscous, it will not flow. It has to be pushed out at the top of the volcano or out of the ground if there's a dome on the ground, and that happens in some places. And it's like you squeeze a toothpaste tube and it comes out. And that's under pressure, it comes out. Now, these columns are special. They are well known to rock climbers. They call them the feathers. These are 15 to 20 or more feet in diameter. And this is a gap right here where you can walk through. If it's kind of cool, then you go through and get on the sunny side, the other side to the south, and do your climbing on that side. If it's hot, then you stay on this side of the basalt columns to do your climbing. And then you can go through that opening and walk up. There's some broken columns. You get clear up to the top of the columns and go out on the first one or two columns that are to the right of this picture for a great viewpoint down to the river and to the two receding waterfalls. This is kind of, these were so big that the water that was coming across Washington, the Lake Missoula floodwater, and more likely the global floodwater earlier, it was, as it goes down the slope to the river from the upper plateau, it cuts a channel, and then that there's a water, it begins to be have a waterfall, and that recedes, receding waterfall, making it a longer and longer channel. Well, this is dividing that into two separate receding waterfalls because the water could not move these. Now, this is a favorite place, and until just this year, you could go here. How many of you, raise your hand if you've been to Catherine Creek? Well, you are a ways away from it. Okay, it's in the Columbia Gorge, and from Hood River you cross over to Bingen and White Salmon, and go a distance maybe about 8 or 9 miles, and take a little side road and get up a little higher. And this is right here the end of a lava flow. Okay, and there's a this is a crevasse. It goes back behind this arch on both sides. And you can see that this area here is where the columns fell off. So all these vertical columns, well, here's a couple of big boulders here, and they are big chunks of columns that used to be up in this space. There's about 5 of these that fell out. And so there are, I believe, 5 or some smaller ones, 7 different arches like this. There's another arch that's even bigger than this one. When you're going between Hood River and the Dalles, you get past Mosier and you get almost to Rowena, which is just before the Dalles, going east. You look across the river from the Oregon side and you see vertical basalt. Now, the layers are horizontal like this normally. They can get bent and tilted, okay? But if you have a lot of pressure squeezing this and the tectonic forces in the earth do that in many places, it puts this pressure on and you get this bend. So now this layer has been bent up and it keeps pushing against this and it actually breaks it loose from the other horizontal things here. So here this is horizontal still, but this part here has been broken loose and these are standing. These are layers, but now the layers are vertical. And then you've got a tougher material. This right up here is the entablature. This is the colonnade area. Think of an Egyptian or a Roman or a Greek column. Okay, the vertical part is the colonnade and the top is the entablature. Well, the entablature for the lava is much tougher It holds itself together better than the columns do. And for that reason, it can stay in place when columns fall away. And that's how you get an archway like this. Well, the other arch I want to tell you about in these vertical rocks. So we have verticals like this. And the first one is about 50 feet. The space in here, that means the columns, it was 50, maybe 75 feet, that particular layer of basalt. It flipped up like this. Well, 25 feet of it, the wall is still there. That's entablature, the top part. And the part that fell away, the colonnade part, is the 50 feet that's gone. So there's a gap between these. And then between the walls. Okay, wall here, space, a little smaller space here, and a bunch of columns that are still together here, but they're vertical. Well, in this column here, if you look up the hill, it's very steep. You can actually see a great big arch on the slope, about this steep. It's quite a climb up there. This arch is big enough that you could take 3 full-size school buses, not that you could get them up there, and put them end-to-end in that archway. It's that big. So you can go up there and walk in there. It's a great place. It's cool up in there. And then you can walk back between the next two arches, and there's a slope, and get up there. And if it's during nesting season for the hawks, you're going to be getting up close to their nests, and they're going to be diving at you, warning you, don't get near our nest. So Catherine Crick, great wildflowers in the spring. You'd enjoy going there. Nice little hike. In the spring, there's a little creek. It's dry now. Now we're going to switch topics a little bit here. Let me go to this other one first. Okay, well, no, I'll go here. Okay. This is a channel carved through some backwater sediments. And so I think I probably will come back to that. I want to get the picture together. I see that's a little out of order. Okay, talking about the Lake Missoula flood, okay. Aha, here we go. Okay. During the end of the Ice Age, and the Ice Age was caused by Noah's flood, because the ocean was, by the end of Noah's flood, because of all the volcanic activity underwater, and made the water quite warm. And when it's done, the flood is, water's gone, weather fronts coming off the Pacific or in the Atlantic, coming off the Atlantic, going inland, they will drop maybe rain on the shoreline, but because there's so much ash and aerosols from volcanic activity is still going on, there's not as much heat from the sun. So inland, it snows. And why is it going to build up like this so much? Well, because the warm water means, the warm ocean water, means that there's going to be more water picked up by that weather front coming in. And it's, so it drops it as rain on the shore, and then it drops it as snow inland. And it just keeps building up. More and more snow, more and more snow. It starts to pack. It can get a mile or more deep, and actually more than that. But as it's packing, then it becomes, the geologists call it, it becomes fern. It's not quite solid ice yet, but it's approaching it. And there's more weight of more snow on top, then it actually will recrystallize and become ice. So you'll have glacial ice. And so you have the glaciers. And as they there's a higher elevation here. This is mountains. So these are montane glaciers. One comes down into the Puget Sound, and we're blessed with our nice waterfront around Seattle and the whole Puget Sound area, carved out by one of the lobes of the Cordilleran lobe of the ice sheet. Over here, we have the Okanagan lobe that blocked the Columbia River over here. And then over here, we have the Purcell lobe that blocks the Clark Fork River drainage, not just one river, but the whole drainage there. So, and that dam is actually, it's right here. This is the lobe right here. There's some over here, but this one right here is the Purcell. Now, that blocks the Clark Fork drainage, and so the water can't get out of Montana through the Clark Fork drainage. Many of you are probably familiar with the Lake Missoula floods. In fact, that's what we're going to be exploring, part of that, over at the Grand Coulee and the Dry Falls on Saturday. Ron Payne and I, and come join us, the Puget Sound CAPS group. Okay, so this gets to be, at the height of it, about 2,000 feet, almost a half a mile deep of water. And as it has risen, it just goes clear down to Missoula, and that's why it's called Lake Missoula. So that water is just, you know, trapped there until it's released. Well, eventually, when it's almost a half a mile deep, what does ice want to do on water? Float, right? Okay, and so now the ice is beginning to want to rise because of all that water there. And then there's also pressure of the water that wants to squeeze water underneath the glacier. And that combination of water starting to go under and the water lifting the ice, once it starts to break, it will work its way. There's more than 50 miles across this dam. And it'll just keep on going. And you have a dam burst when it finally gets so that all that water right here can drain. It's 540 cubic miles of water. That's a lot of water. And if it all came through in 2 days, that would be 10 times the flow of all the rivers on Earth, all the water that goes into the ocean, rivers and creeks and streams. Now, if it took 2 weeks instead of 2 days to get out, then it might still be approaching about equal to the flow of the rivers, all the rivers of the world going in each day. That much water coming out until the water's gone during those 2 weeks. Just a little more while we're on this one. Okay, so the water comes out and it goes into another lake that is blocked by the Okanagan lobe blocking the Columbia River. So this lake was already quite high. It didn't take much water from the water in the Lake Missoula flood to fill the lake, and then it starts overflowing, and you see these little pathways here, this network. This is the water coming out about 400 feet deep, going across the state of Washington towards the south, and it goes backwater up various places, like the Snake River, Wallula Gap. 100 miles backwards, the water goes up there. The Walla Walla River goes backwards, okay? And when it's going backwards, it's taking sediment with it. It's laying down layers, and there's many places that are called rhythmites. You could actually see the earlier stages, the bottom layers might be 4 feet deep, gravels and dirt and some sand with them, okay? And then as you get to the higher levels, it'll get to 2 feet and 1 foot and maybe 8 or 10 inches at the top. And let me go, in a moment, go back to that slide I was going to show. So here we have the, it gets down to Wallula Gap right in here, and it can't all get out fast enough. At the Tri-Cities, it's like a dam But it's a dam with a big wide opening in the base of it, which is the river channel. And so, but the water backs up, okay, until it can all get through. When it gets down here, it gets backed up again by the narrowness of the canyon at Rowena, and that's real close to, just have you get out of the Dalles and go a little bit west into the gorge. It's real narrow there, and that makes another dam, and that goes from here almost back to the Tri-Cities. So it's a series of dammed up lakes. Only this one was dammed by ice. The others are dammed by narrow channels. It's called a hydraulic dam. It's still flowing, but it can't get through fast enough, so it backs up. When it gets down to the Willamette Valley, it and gets up here to Kelso and Longview in that area, narrow channel again, backs up, and it backs up clear down to Eugene. Yeah. And somebody mentioned the other day, how about the soil in the Willamette Valley? A great place to raise vegetables and a lot of produce. Well, a lot of that soil came from up here and got carried down and left here. Well, it's being brought in, but this is quiet water because it's a lake. It's not leaving, so it's going to be starting to fill here, but then as it more and more comes, it kind of spreads out and you get this nice soil in there. Eventually, it makes its way then to the coast, and it drops a lot of material out. Carves a little bit of a canyon here underwater, which extends into the edge of the land, edge of Washington. Oregon, it's the boundary between the two. Columbia River. Okay, this is the backwater rhythmites at Walla Walla. Well, let's get rid of that one. Well, let's try again. There we go. Now, this is on the Walla Walla River, and water was coming through, and it was it went backwards, bringing sediments up, because the water rose and brought muds and little gravels up and made layers in and filled in the river. Okay, and only later, when water could go down and cut back through it, would you find this kind of thing. Well, this particular one is out in somebody's field. This is his field. He was growing things here, and they were had so much tumbleweeds that had blown into their irrigation ditch. They decided that they've got to do something because they can't open take a board or two out, because it gets clogged up with the tumbleweeds. So they decided they'd take about three or four boards out, just let a whole bunch of water go, and it would take the tumbleweeds with it. It did that. And it went down in their ditch, and it went out onto their field, which is normally okay, but not that much water. When you're irrigating, you don't need that much. When you put this much, it made this little canyon through their field. And that's more than 100 feet deep. And the layers start out 4 feet deep of sediment, and then they work their way at the very top to about 6 inches deep, but there's about over 30 layers in there, okay? And right about this level, there's two layers of white ash. It's Mount St. Helens ash. At the time that this area was getting these backwater rhythmites laid down, backwater layers, the volcano was erupting, and there were two separate eruptions that put a lot of ash out, about this thick for the first layer, and then there's a layer of just more sediments from the backwater sediments. And then there's another eruption, maybe just hours, maybe a day or so apart, and you get another layer of ash, two layers. And they can identify when those happened. Mount St. Helens is someplace between 70 years and 120 years between eruptions. What was the captain that came by sailboat up the Columbia River? Is it Captain Cook, was it? Vancouver? Yeah. Well, he saw Mount St. Helens going off. Okay, so that's documented, that date, one of the earliest sightings by Europeans. Okay, and the Native Americans had seen many, many eruptions. And then there's been several since then. I think I'm going to just allow you to ask any questions if you want to ask questions about the Lake Missoula flood and all the things you've seen that took place here. And then, because I'm going to change topics now to another item. And you can still ask questions on it later, too, if you wish. In fact, if I can get it going here, I'll show you a little video on that. Okay.
If anybody has a question, just let me know. Put up your hand and I'll bring the mic to you.
Hi. The flow that went out the Columbia River to, forms Washington, Oregon. Mm-hmm. Down the Oregon coast just a little bit, there's the underwater petrified forest.
Yes.
Is that all part of that?
Actually, that's a separate thing. There were trees that were brought in floating, and they were root masses, because you don't find the tree. You find a bunch of roots, right? And you've seen some of them you've seen some vertical trees also?
I've lived on the
Oregon. Okay, yeah.
And they had an article in the paper about
the petrified trees
that they had found upright
in the sediment offshore.
Coast, yeah.
Offshore, yeah.
On low tide, you can see some.
Yeah, I've heard about that, but I haven't studied it, so I can't intelligently talk about that. How about you? Do you remember anything about that? Yeah, Heinz?
No.
Okay, yeah. You can look it up online probably and get the information. What I was going to say is something else. Masses of the root system of trees also got brought up, and they've started to mineralize. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, show me again. Yeah, I want to do a DVD here, so let's... I need to find that again. It's in...
this one. Open.
You sure that's it?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so. You have to go to documents, don't you, and pull up... something there.
Did you have some other topics you want to cover as well?
Yeah, I'm going to do some more of those. I should drop that down, but let me see if I can find this. That's it. You have to go to all programs. So we go to documents, okay, and then we go, and then. Yeah, uh-huh. All, you have to find all programs, and it's under documents, isn't it?
From the start icon, down in the lower left-hand corner.
Right here, okay, there we go, all programs. Thank you. Let's go there again. Okay. There we go. Now, we can go up to Windows Media Player. Okay. And should be able to see a list.
No, it's the one on the far right, the far left at the bottom.
Far left at the bottom.
There.
This one right here.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Okay, number six. Okay, here we go. Now, this is a little DVD.
And this is where the Lake Missoula flood comes into play. It's perfect for showing us what massive floodwaters can do.
Okay, I'm going to go back and show you one other thing just before that. Okay, the gorge. I have to get the... There, DVD menu. Okay, here's the boat that they use, okay? Scene selection, okay. Okay, this is the Pike family that live in the Gresham area, and they made this this DVD, okay? I'm just gonna show you as they, I'll advance it a little bit here. Now they're in the boat. Well, I advanced it too much. Okay. Okay, now I'll try this. They're gathering their family up, walking towards the boat. Where's that? Oh, yeah, okay. And you see they lift the plane up and put it right there on the back of the boat. Okay, now I'm going to go to another section of this. If I can find it here. Should be able to advance to other ones. And I'm not, both Heinz and I are having a time remembering how we go to the next one. Actually, I should find that list, shouldn't I? And the list, I can click on the list and I want number six, Missoula flood. Let me see if I can find that. No. Oh, well, start again. Oh, okay. All programs. Is that where you're thinking I should go? Okay. Media player. Okay. Drop this one down. Okay. Let's try that again. All programs. Okay. Media player. There we go. There we go. That's what I want. Just do one of these sections here. Maybe one other one.
And this is where the Lake Missoula flood comes into play. It's perfect for showing us what massive floodwaters can do. The Missoula flood defies the theory that says it takes millions of years to create such dramatic geology. What looks like millions of years of erosion was carved in only days.
This is dry falls from the air. This is leading to the dry falls, and here's another scarp. The waterfall went over 400 feet. It's right this thing over here. It's all the way up.
Glacial ice sheet flooded the Clark Fork River in Idaho. This caused the river to backflood the valleys of Montana, centering in what is now Missoula, Montana. After several decades of rising water, the lake was 2,000 feet deep at the huge ice dam. It was about the size of Lake Erie and Lake Ontario combined. The dam catastrophically broke loose, releasing 500
kilograms
of water.
Which arrow?
Across Washington State at speeds of 680 miles per hour and depths from 300 to 1,000 feet deep.
Okay.
Okay. Community of the 20th century. The Grand Coulee.
There we are.
A canyon over 50 miles long with vertical cliffs reaching 900 feet high. The floodwaters blasted out the rock like a massive jackhammer, leaving vertical cliff walls on each side. All the excavated rock was lifted in the torrent and transported violently out. Dry falls. A dry waterfall dropping 400 feet down with a span of 3.5 miles across. It was carved out while submerged under the floodwaters. The channeled scablands. The land is stripped of topsoil, with the bedrock cut and gouged. Channels have been cut through the hard basalt rock, ranging from 100 to 400 feet deep.
The volume.
The results of the erosion can even be seen from space. Huge potholes cover
the
strip surface.
Now we have to go our picture back.
Fields full of huge boulders. Boulders ripped from the coulees and then dropped as the water spread out and slowed down.
The remains of another dry waterfall called Ancient Lakes at Potholes Coulee, with plunge pools at the bottom of a 400-foot drop. From eastern Washington, the floodwaters channel through the Wallula Gap. Now following the Columbia River's path, the floodwaters found their way to the gorge. Being relatively narrow for that much water, the waters were again forced up to 60 to 80 miles per hour and climbed 800 to 1,000 feet deep, inflicting wreckage all the way. The Cape Horn Cliffs are the ruins of the last great barrier that resisted the massive wall of water as it approached the exit from the gorge. Sheer cliffs, ranging from 600 to 900 feet high, were blasted out.
What's our depth, Freeman?
87 feet.
Wow.
87 feet down, the flood carved out more than we can even see.
Hey, let's go up top.
Okay, I'm going to stop it right there. Now, back to the other program. So you kind of got double duty on that. I explained a little bit about the Lake Missoula flood, and now you've seen a video of some of that. So we're back in the gorge, and let's pick up where we left off there. Okay. Now this is pillow lava. That's around, that's evidence that the lava, the Columbia River basalt, was flowing underwater and it was Noah's flood water. Okay, now let's get to the right place here. Here we, okay. Know which one I'm looking for. I just need to find the right one here. Yeah, right there. Here it is, right there. Okay, here we go. I think we can. I can see it now. I can. There we go. We did the backwater rhythmites, the basalt erratic, that we did the Burlingame rhythmites. Now, let's do the Camas Prairie. Okay, this is on the border between Montana and Idaho, the Camas Prairie, and the water leaving Lake Missoula was going across here. The ice dam had broken, which is farther to the west, okay? And so as the water's moving, it is like a stream moves sand along the stream, makes those ripples along. You've seen them in a stream bed. Well, these are giant ripples. Some of them are 30 feet high. So a lot of people had farms in here and didn't realize what it was until this was studied more. They realized, oh, where our house and our barn are built between some of these ripples. Now, when the water gets over into Washington and is moving, it moved some huge quantities of rocks and gravels and sand, and this is a huge boulder. That there's two choices for how boulders like this are moved. One, one of the glacial ice lobes of the continental glacier, as it's coming down, it breaks off some of the basalt and it carries it in the ice, and then sometimes it can be like a iceberg carrying material. Another time, if there's enough force of the water, it could roll smaller things out, like down through the Grand Coulee, you got the Dry Falls, then you got the Lower Coulee, you got the lakes, and you got Spirit or Soap Lake. And when the water gets out of that lower part of the Grand Coulee, it kind of spreads out over the flatter area to the south of Soap Lake and leaves all sizes of rocks. And this is one of the big boulders that was left. It probably got rolled out. And that was near Hatchery Road. It's about 4 miles south of and a little bit to the east from Soap Lake on Hatchery Road. Let's switch now from the Lake Missoula flood to the John Day area. How many of you have been to the John Day in eastern Oregon? Okay. It's a place where there's beautiful rock layers, and this is the Cathedral Rock. You've got the greens, yellows, and reddish up at the top. These are sediments that were deposited, and they are, a lot of it's ash, okay? There's tan, there's red, and there's greens. In this particular spot, it's got these beautiful bands in it. Now there's the area called the Clarno area, and you can actually, in the ash, which is now rock, you can find fossils. And this, I believe, is an alder leaf, but I've seen maple leaves and oak leaves, very delicate structures preserved. You've got the image of the leaf there in the ash. That's the westernmost part of the John Day as you first come into it. Right near there is the Painted Hills. And this is very interesting. And here's your reds and your yellows, and there's some black. So the red and the yellows, that's iron, and then the blacks are manganese or magnesium. And this again is ash with the minerals in it. But it easily erodes. You see all the gullies in here, okay? And the water then comes down through, and the stream that's leaving after a rainstorm will take a reddish color. If it's coming over an area like we saw the Cathedral Rock, it'll be green. The color of kind of a blue-green will be the color of the water. And there's one area I noticed where water was coming from two different sides of the stream, and there was blue coming in from one side and red from the other, so you had the two colors running along the shore, and then they got mixed in the middle during a rainstorm. In that area where I saw that was, this is what is called Sheep Rock. It's in the picture, Gorge Canyon, a second important area in the John Day Monument. And here you see the greenish again. And this layer right here is a little bit of basalt, and then here's some tan-colored ash material, and up on top is basalt, Columbia River basalt, and over here on both sides of the canyon at the same level as the top of this is where you have the basalt. So you got the fossil hunting area, you've got sheep rock, and you've got the areas that have the blue layers farther down this canyon. Okay, let's look at Mount St. Helens just a little bit here. Okay, here's Spirit Lake. And after the blast, that was August 18. I remember it well. My brother especially remembered it. It's his birthday in 1980. Most of this material was blown into this lake by the 300-mile-an-hour blast coming off Mount St. Helens. And when they flew a plane over, and a lot of ash had fallen. Okay, so there was ash on top of these logs and all over the ground. And so when they flew, as soon as it was safe enough, took a helicopter across, and they looked, and they said, the lake's gone. Well, the logs were covering it, and they were covered with ash, so they thought the lake was gone. And then when the wind blew, it blew the logs over so they could see water again, and they realized what had happened. Okay, so these logs, as they are in the water, they're going to get waterlogged and drop. So I've got a picture here on that. Well, let's go to this one. Okay, see, they're floating on top of the water, and they get waterlogged, and then they'll be bobbing with just the tips out of the water, and then they'll drop and they'll be standing. And if they don't get buried by sediment, and these have got buried by ash and other things from the volcano, then they'll remain standing, and they can be petrified in that position. And here's one that's prone then, that didn't stay standing. Uh-oh. Made that disappear again. Okay. You have to just click on the wrong spot. Here we go. Let's switch over to the Grand Tetons. The beauty of those mountains. And these are granite and gneiss and schist. And at the Grand Canyon, at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, it's granite and gneiss and schist. Okay? There's a mountain here. Let's go to this specific mountain in the Tetons. This is Mount Moran. And Mount Moran, how many have been to the Grand Tetons? South of Yellowstone. Oh, a lot of you have. Okay. You remember the mountain, you look across Jenny Lake, and you can see up here this great big dark reddish brown dike of lava, and then sticking out from the mountainside because the material has been eroded away because it came up in a large crack. It extruded.